kids eligible to be vaccinated. This is a day so many parents eager to protect their young children from this virus have been waiting for. Pfizer's chief executive officer Albert Bourla said in a statement, over 6 million children in the United States have been diagnosed with COVID-19 since the start of this pandemic, and a high number of young people continue to be infected every week. With this FDA authorization, we have achieved another key marker in our ongoing effort to help protect families and communities and to get this disease under control. The agency's Vaccine Advisory Committee earlier this week announced overwhelming support for use of the vaccine shot, which Pfizer estimates to be over 90% effective in the age group. The decision now heads to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC's Vaccine Committee, which will take up the issue early next week, making the shots available to kids as early as midweek. The Biden administration has already published its plan to distribute the vaccine shots should they gain authorization, which includes sending the shots to more than 25,000 pediatric offices and other primary care sites, over 100 children's hospital systems, and tens of thousands of pharmacies. Hundreds of schools and community-based clinics will also get them. But making the vaccine shots available does not mean the majority of parents will be on board. According to a survey data released this week by the Kaiser Family Foundation, 3 in 10 American parents say they will definitely not get their 5 to 11-year-old kids vaccinated against the coronavirus, with the majority citing potential unknown long-term effects and serious side effects of the vaccine as the main reason for their concern. Still, getting a large share of the child population vaccinated would have a big impact on the pandemic's outlook, according to the country's leading infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci. Dr. Fauci said at a recent press conference, "If we can get the overwhelming majority of those 28 million children vaccinated, I think that will play a major role in diminishing the spread of infection in the community." In announcing its authorization of a lower-dose shot made by Pfizer and BioNTech for the 5 to 11-year-old age group, the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, said clinical trial data showed the shot was safe and prompted strong immune responses in children. The most common side effects were fatigue, fever, and headache. Infectious disease experts say that with approaching holiday travel and family gatherings, widespread vaccination of younger children could be a game changer. It could help keep classes in person, reduce the likelihood of quarantines, and lessen the risk of transmission to older, more vulnerable adults, as well as protect the children from what has become the 8th biggest killer in their age group, according to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC. To date, nearly 2 million American children aged between 5 and 11 have been infected with the coronavirus, and 8,300 have been hospitalized. A third of those hospitalized were admitted to intensive care units, and at least 170 children have died. But a report this month from researchers at Northeastern University, Harvard University, Rutgers University, and Northwestern University found that parental concerns around the COVID vaccination had increased significantly from June through to September. Chief among them, researchers said, were the newness of the vaccine, whether it has been sufficiently tested, its efficacy, its side effects, and long-term health consequences. According to a survey released on Thursday, 28th of October, by the Kaiser Family Foundation, scarcely 1 in 3 parents will permit their children in this newly eligible age group to be vaccinated immediately. Two-thirds of parents were either reluctant or adamantly opposed to giving vaccine shots to their children. An Axios Ipsos poll found that 42% of parents said they were unlikely to have their children vaccinated.
Communique.
7 people were shot dead and dozens more wounded in the Lebanese capital Beirut after snipers belonging to the Lebanese Forces militia opened fire at a peaceful protest led by Hezbollah and Amal protesters. In the mainstream media, they've called them clashes. Many Lebanese accuse them of purposely hiding or obfuscating the identities of the victims and even of blaming Hezbollah for the violence. So were these just clashes, as some in the media have suggested, or something more sinister aimed at provoking a reaction from Hezbollah, an escalation, and dragging Lebanon into a civil war? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. October 14th, 7 people were martyred and dozens more wounded after snipers opened fire at protesters in Beirut's Tayuna district. The majority of the victims, supporters of Hezbollah and its ally, the Amal movement, who'd gathered outside the Palace of Justice. Intended as a peaceful, unarmed protest, Hezbollah called for the demonstration the day before to protest against a judge named Tariq Bitar, who people accuse of politicizing the investigation into the Beirut port explosion. Lebanese daily Al-Akhbar reported that the American ambassador to Lebanon, Dorothy Shia, was attempting to frame Hezbollah for the explosion and influence the investigation. As protesters gathered outside the Palace of Justice, sniper fire began to erupt as gunmen on the surrounding buildings began firing at the protesters from rooftops and other vantage points. After the violence erupted, the armed wings of these groups then arrived with weapons to defend the protesters. And I think this is a very important point to understand, because some people in the Western mainstream media and Lebanese media have referred to the massacre as a clash, implying an exchange of fire between two sides. But is that really how things went down? Because when snipers start shooting at protesters, that's an ambush. It's an attack. It's not a clash, which would require both sides to be fighting from the start. Now, some people have also posted videos online saying, look, you see, the protesters were armed. Hezbollah and Amal, they brought weapons to the protest. They asked for it. But this is, again, untrue. One of the martyrs was a mother waiting at the window for her children to come home from school. She wasn't even at the protest, let alone carrying a weapon. How do you explain her death? The demonstration that took place was live-streamed. There are tons of videos and photographs showing very clearly that no one was armed. You can see here, as the shooting begins, there isn't a single weapon in the entire shot. The videos of people carrying weapons are from afterwards, after the snipers had already shot and killed protesters. It's only then that people came from nearby districts in order to defend the protesters. So that's a completely different story and a very important distinction to make. All the victims had head wounds, indicating a clear intent to kill, not to deter, nor disperse, nor defend, or whatever other excuse the apologists for this massacre have concocted. The Lebanese army even put out a tweet confirming that protesters had been shot at. They didn't say that armed groups or personnel were shot at, they said protesters. The Minister of Interior also confirmed that this was indeed a massacre, an ambush, and not some clash. Of course, some people in the media, they don't even want to disclose the identity of the victims. Hezbollah is always the bad guy, according to them. So when Hezbollah supporters are being massacred in broad daylight, this runs counter to their usual narrative. And if you look at the various headlines in the press, you can see how they use this passive language to avoid telling the truth. If you read their headlines, you would never know what actually happened and who was shot at. So they're basically lying about what happened, either calling it a clash or trying to obfuscate the identity of the victims. And we know that the victims are mostly Hezbollah and MLS supporters. So what about the perpetrators? Who was behind the attack? Well, the Lebanese army has so far arrested a total of 19 people in connection with the attack. It is widely assumed that a right-wing Christian militia and a rival of Hezbollah, known as the Lebanese Forces, they were behind the massacre. And if you knew anything about the history of the Lebanese Forces and the history of their leader, Samir Jaja, this would hardly surprise you. As a matter of fact, this recent attack pales in comparison with their other atrocities when they killed scores of Christians, Muslims, Palestinians, Armenians. Not only that, but during the Lebanese Civil War, the Lebanese Forces militia committed treason and collaborated with Israel, an invading and occupying force, to carry out these attacks. They received funding, clothing, and weapons from the Israelis. And in September 1982, together, they committed one of the most horrific massacres, murdering 3,500 Palestinians and Lebanese Shia in Beirut. The leader of the Lebanese Forces militia, Samir Jaja, was also found guilty of assassinating the Lebanese Prime Minister, Rashid Karami, in 1987, and Danish Amoun in 1990. Today, Jaja also enjoys funding and support from Saudi Arabia and the United States, who have a vested interest in fracturing Lebanon and weakening Hezbollah.
One of the victims, Mohammed Tamer, is reported to have been killed not by the Lebanese Forces militia, but actually by the Lebanese army. The authenticity of CCTV footage posted online appeared to be confirmed when the Lebanese army said that the soldier in question is now under investigation.
The scenes of this latest massacre in Beirut are a painful reminder to many of Lebanon's civil war, which lasted 15 years and took place on these very streets. It is with that in mind that Hezbollah and Emel released an official statement following the shooting, asking people to remain calm and refrain from retaliating to the murders, for fear of escalating the situation and dragging Lebanon into another civil war, which is perhaps what Jaja and his backers would very much like to do. To discuss more, I'm joined by Zainab El-Safar. She's an Iraqi-Lebanese journalist and the host of the television program Min Al-Dakhil, which airs weekly on El Mayadin. First of all, let me say thank you, Zainab, for coming on the program. It's great to finally have you on the show.
Thank you for having me, Richard. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
So, Zainab, can you perhaps just walk us through what happened yesterday in Beirut? First of all, why were people outside? What were they protesting against? Who was protesting? And what is really the issue at hand?
At the night before, the eve before, there were certain kind of suspicious movements in the neighborhoods facing the place that the events took place yesterday. And this is something very suspicious because, you know, when such kind of movements, mobilizations take place by people in black and they are trying to secure certain kind of neighborhoods, avenues, and streets, and they were trying to deploy their militias over there, and the security forces and the various security forces, they didn't move an eye to all this kind of movement. We have to ask questions and we have to pose questions as, where is the preemptive security that ought to be there at certain points in time? So the next day, the people who were on the streets, let me just tell you and walk you through the events that took place. It is in repercussion to the politicizing of the judge that is in charge of the probe of the Beirut blast that occurred last year on the 4th of August. This particular judge, this unfortunately, we tend to call them justice, but there is no justice in what they are doing. His measures are so discretionary and politicized to the sense that he wanted to deviate the probe from its ultimate aims. And he issued certain kind of subpoenas and orders that were really so suspicious. They were highly politicized. There is no kind of justice or order in whatever he was doing. So the people took to the streets, civilians, unarmed, peaceful demonstrators, people who belong to the elite of Lebanon, lawyers, engineers, teachers, they took to the streets and they were unarmed. Okay, so what happened is that the moment they took to the streets at 10:45 a.m. exactly, fire, sniper fire, heavy a salvo of sniper fire were started to shoot in their direction. We had seven martyrs, among them a woman, Maryam Farhat. She's the mother of five. I cannot just put them into words and say what has happened. It's like a kind of dragging the people. The events, you know, if you just want to paint the picture, they were so much reminiscent of what took place, what instigated the Lebanese civil war back in 1975. The place and the way the events were taking place and escalating. 4 hours of intense gunfire, incessant gunfire. What does that mean? And nothing happened to stop them.
When you mention this poor woman who was killed in her home, and you know the protesters were unarmed, I mean, this is a very important point, because you have a lot of people posting videos, people online saying that the protesters were armed, that they came to the protest with weapons. Is that true? Or were those videos from afterwards, after the snipers had already shot and killed some of the protesters in front of the Palace of Justice?
Unfortunately, Richard, a lot of media outlets, local media outlets and foreign media outlets, are accomplices in the crime that took place against the people, the innocent people of demonstration. The way they were trying to promote that this matter has boiled down into clashes. Clashes take place between two sides. But this is, you know, the Lebanese forces, militias, those lunatic mercenaries performing, perpetrating this massacre, this intended, pre-planned, pre-orchestrated, and perpetrated massacre against civilians. They were trying to show that the matter is only a kind of clashes, you know, an action and a reaction. No way. Nobody. We said and we underscored the fact that those protesters were unarmed and were peaceful, and they were from the elite, as I said. Those people, they shot at a demonstration, demonstrators, they shot back, and there was an exchange of fire. This was not the case at all. Only the army, you know, deployed, and they deployed their armored personnel, and they were trying to take hold of the situation. 4 hours of intense fire until they tried to apprehend those perpetrators, and 8 of them are apprehended, and they said that, well, they admitted what they were doing.
What did you make of not just local commentators, but international media portraying it as, you know, a fight between two sides, and omitting the victims, that they're Hezbollah and Amal supporters, from the headlines, the subheadings, you know, it just wasn't there.
Mm-hmm. It was a kind of, you know, it's part also of the whole choir of trying to show that, well, you know, it's the beginning, the flames of a civil war that is has just erupted and is going to burn Lebanon. It's between a Christian side, you know, and even in the geography, Ain al-Rumani, you say Christian side populated by the Christians, and then you say Ash-Shia and Tayuni is populated by the Shia mostly, and you say that, well, it's a kind of civil war between the Christians and the Shia. Amal and Hezbollah, they represent the greatest number of Shia in Lebanon, but this was not that, and this is what they want to sell, because, you know, as we all know, that Hezbollah has a very deep-rooted alliance with the Free Patriotic Movement, which is one of the biggest Christian parties in Lebanon, and also Amal Movement has also alliance with the Merida. Hezbollah has also with the Merida. They are all Christians, and they are also people who suffered from the massacres perpetrated by the Lebanese forces against their own people, the Christians, their fellow Christians themselves. The Lebanese forces, party and militia, what they were doing is what they have always been doing, what they are used to be doing. They are mercenaries in the hands of those who pay the higher bid. You know, they are funded by certain Arab regimes, and they take the orders from the Americans, and they perpetrate massacres. We don't, it does not escape us ever, you know, what happened in Sabra and Shatila, and who was responsible for what happened in Sabra and Shatila, where 3,500 people, innocent Palestinians and Lebanese, at least 80 people from Al-Muqdad family, they have been assassinated assassinated in a mode which is they have been butchered. Women, children, elderly, they have been butchered in the Sabra neighborhood just adjacent to the Shatila refugee camp.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, the Lebanese army, they arrested members of this Christian militia, the Lebanese forces, for this attack. But it's not really out of place for them, is it? I mean, they have a whole history of this barbarism, let's call it what it is, this barbarism against all various walks of life in Lebanon, as you mentioned. And I think it's really important for people to understand what they are. You know, it's really astonishing for me that someone like Zsa Zsa is a free man. It's really unconscionable, isn't it?
Yes, he was given amnesty back in 2005, and then you know how events escalated back in 2005 with the assassination of the slain Prime Minister Rafiq al-Hariri, and then how Lebanon went into this kind of, those events that the aim and target of which was to target the resistance in Lebanon. Then you had 2006, which is the Israeli aggression against Lebanon. But, you know, whoever stood in the face of the resistance has always been defeated. And Hezbollah in Lebanon is part and parcel of the fabric. It is a community. It has a large swathe of constituency. And we have to understand something, speaking of constituency, is that we are very soon approaching the elections in Lebanon, the parliamentary elections. And whatever we see, any kind of instability, any kind of event, is going to be in order to try and tip the balance of elections, because the Lebanese forces, they know for sure that, you know, former member of parliament, Walid Jumblatt, is no longer aligning with them in Baabda and Ashouf, and he said so clearly. And also, Al-Hariri, which is the future bloc, is not aligning with them in the Akkar region, in the Hirmil, and somewhere else. So they are, according to this new electoral law, they will be losing a lot of seats in the forthcoming elections. And whatever they have done, Richard, they opened their own fire at themselves. This is not something that is going to pass easily. The blood of the martyrs is not going to stay on the streets. There's going to be a kind of accountability, a solid accountability, a vendetta also, not only from those particular people, the way, you know, those people who were also responsible for the events that took place in Khaldi and the killing, the cold blood killing of the people in Khaldi, and those who were also the next day in the funeral procession. Their masters, who are the servants of another master, which is a master that was and is always defeated today, defeated in Afghanistan, defeated in Iraq, defeated in Syria, defeated elsewhere, is also going to be defeated in Lebanon, Richard, sooner rather than later.
Zainab, when you speak of their masters, this is a very important point. What role do the United States, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Israel, what role do they play in this attack and in Lebanese politics in general? Is it true, for example, that the Lebanese forces militia was training in Saudi Arabia? You know, what else is the American embassy, what role does the American ambassador play in all this? And what goal are they trying to achieve here? You mentioned destabilizing the elections as one example. Is this also part of a plan to weaken the axis of resistance, to disarm Hezbollah? What about Lebanon's gas and natural resources?
Of course, everything that the Americans have been doing in the region and also in Lebanon in particular, the sanctions against Lebanon, the sanctions against lots of personalities who are allied with the resistance in Lebanon, it's a mode of trying to weaken the resistance in Lebanon and trying to turn the people of Lebanon, the people of the resistance, against their own resistance. And, you know, the American ambassador has been doing all this witchcraft, if I might say, all these kind of suspicious and all these kind of, you know, the imperial moves trying to control Lebanon and the Lebanese institutions, but she's failing. And, you know, the moment Hezbollah tried to get the ship of fuel from Iran, the next day she said that, well, we're going to get gas from Egypt through Syria. Syria that was sanctioned by the very Americans through the Caesar law. They broke the Caesar law, and you know, and she was reprimanded by her administration, saying that, well, you don't need this Sayyid Nasrallah to do something, and then you have to retaliate the next day to show that you are strong and flexing your muscles. But anyways, she is doing her best. She is on the line of the Pompeo recommendations, still trying to, in her dreams, she dreams a lot, that she dreams of disbanding and disarming Hezbollah and, you know, dismantling this kind of party and the people of it, and turning the people of the resistance and the quote-unquote Shia against Hezbollah. Well, this is just in your dreams. These are chimeras, and this is something that can never be true. Regarding the fact that we heard yesterday a very important statement by the mother of the martyr, Maryam Farhat, in yesterday's events, in the massacre that took place yesterday. She said, well, they are not going to move us one iota against the resistance. We know those scenarios. We know the play, this theatrical thing that is taking place against us. We know the ultimate aims of, and we're not going to move. That's why the people of Lebanon yesterday, and I say the people of Lebanon, the true, honest people of Lebanon, they were not being dragged to a kind of civil war, to a kind of sedition, to a kind of discord, because whatever took place, it's not so much strange to us. We know these scenarios, and nobody can drag us again to a civil war.
Zainab Al-Safar, thank you so much for your time. It's really a pleasure having your insightful knowledge and graceful presentation on the program. Really great speaking with you.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Richard. Thank you very much.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
In order to understand the Tayuni massacre that just took place in Beirut, we have to understand the general context of Lebanon's political situation. As we've covered before on the program, Lebanon is under a de facto U.S. siege, its economy in turmoil, and as such, Lebanon remains a very fragile nation in need of political reform. As of recently, Hezbollah has been importing shipments of fuel from Iran to Lebanon, defying not only U.S. sanctions, but also its political rivals inside the country, making them look weak and incompetent as Hezbollah bolsters its image and popularity with the Lebanese people. There are elections coming up soon in Lebanon, and political parties like Jaja's Lebanese forces want to manipulate public opinion against Hezbollah because of their weak standing and the recent political humiliations that they suffer. External actors like the United States, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates have been trying to dismantle Hezbollah for a long time, especially after Hezbollah successfully liberated South Lebanon from Israeli occupation and drove the Israeli invaders back in 2006. The aim of the Tayuni massacre was twofold. One, murdering its supporters to try and provoke Hezbollah into retaliation. The United States, Israel, and Hezbollah's rivals in Lebanon want to paint Hezbollah not as a resistance group, but as some violent armed gang. They want to paint it as an organization that uses violence against its own people so they can try and disarm the group. That way, Hezbollah's political rivals can ascend to power inside Lebanon. The Israelis would no longer face any resistance if they attack or invade Lebanon and Syria. And the United States can go on funding Takfiri terrorists in the region and invading the Middle East with less opposition. So the first aim was to vilify Hezbollah, try and disarm them. The second aim of this massacre was to create sectarian tensions and plunge Lebanon into civil war. Hezbollah and Amal decided not to do either of those things, hence preventing the country from descending into chaos. Let us be clear, everyone has weapons in Lebanon. The difference, however, between the fascist Lebanese forces militia and Hezbollah is that Hezbollah never turns its guns on its own people. It uses them to defend Lebanon from foreign invaders and colonizers. Hezbollah is an integral part of the axis of resistance and is allied with Syria, Iran, and the popular mobilization forces in Iraq. So let's examine the events of the past week, because in Syria, Syria was bombed twice by Israel and the United States, who struck locations in Homs, south of the ancient, the beautiful city of Palmyra, killing one Syrian soldier and wounding three others. In Afghanistan, two suicide bombers struck mosques in Kunduz and Kandahar during Friday prayers, leaving over 100 people wounded or killed, most of the victims Shia Muslims of the Hazara ethnic minority. And then finally in Lebanon, this tragic massacre with snipers firing at peaceful protesters, again, most of them Shia Muslims and supporters of the resistance. All these things point to a concerted effort by the West and its regional allies to destabilize Lebanon, to provoke sectarian violence and start a civil war. They want to pit Muslims against Christians, Shia against Sunni, and destroy the multi-ethnic, multi-religious fabric of Lebanon. Amal and Hezbollah supporters were specifically targeted by fascists who have a long history of murder, and the mainstream media are trying to downplay this and hide it from you. But this plan of theirs to turn people against one another, to weaken Lebanon's security and weaken the axis of resistance, is not going to work. Their intent was clear from the beginning, and this is precisely why Hezbollah and Amal told people not to retaliate. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
For two decades, Americans have told each other one lie after another about the war in Afghanistan, says James Risen, writer, in an article titled, "For two decades, Americans told one lie after another about what they were doing in Afghanistan." Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. For two decades, Americans have told each other one lie after another about the war in Afghanistan. The lies have come from the White House, Congress, the State Department, the Pentagon, and the CIA, as well as from Hollywood, cable news pundits, journalists, and the broader culture. Americans have hungered for a simple storyline, with heroes and villains, to make sense of the longest war in the United States history. They have wanted stories like 12 Strong to make them feel good. But at the very edge of the American empire, the war was nasty and brutish. and brought out in Americans the same imperial arrogance that doomed the U.S. involvement in Vietnam. As the Taliban swiftly take control of Kabul and the American-backed government collapse, the U.S. Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, the government's watchdog over the Afghan experience, issued his final report. The assessment includes remarkably candid interviews with former American officials involved in shaping U.S. policy in Afghanistan that collectively offer perhaps the most biting critique of the 20-year American enterprise ever published in an official U.S. government report. The extraordinary costs were meant to serve a purpose, the report notes, though the definition of that purpose evolved over time. Released in the days after Kabul fell, the report reads like an epitaph for America's involvement in Afghanistan. One of the first things the U.S. did after gaining effective control over Afghanistan following the Taliban's ouster in 2001 was to set up secret torture chambers. Beginning in 2002, the CIA tortured both Afghans and foreign prisoners flown to these torture rooms from all over Central Asia, Africa, the West Asia, North Africa region. The worst torture chamber was nicknamed the Darkness by the prisoners sent there, who suffered such complete sensory deprivation that they did not even know they were in Afghanistan. They were chained in solitary confinement with no light and music blaring constantly. They were hung by their arms for as long as 2 days, slammed against walls, forced to lie naked on traps, while gallons of ice water were poured over their bodies. At least one prisoner died in CIA custody after being left shackled in frigid temperatures. No one was ever held to account for the American torture regime in Afghanistan. American drone strikes also started early in Afghanistan. The CIA killed Al-Qaeda operative Mohammad Atif and others with a drone there in November 2001, just 2 months after 9/11. Afghanistan soon became the beta test site for high-tech drone warfare, leading to countless civilian casualties and deep resentment among the Afghan people, who felt helpless against the unseen threats circling overhead. America's early adoption of drone warfare in Afghanistan helped make a fortune for Neil Blue, the chair of General Atomics. The Southern California Energy and Defense Corporation manufactured the Predator, the first armed drone to fly over Afghanistan. General Atomics subsequently produced the Predator's follow-on model, the Reaper. Blue and his brother, Lyndon Blue, vice chair of General Atomics, maintained low public profiles throughout the war. But as owners of privately held General Atomics, they were among the first but hardly the last American contractors to enrich themselves as blood spilled in Afghanistan. Before long, the CIA's drone campaign shifted from going after the few Al-Qaeda operatives it could find in Afghanistan to targeting the Taliban, thus placing the drone campaign squarely in the midst of Afghan domestic insurgency. The U.S. launched more than 13,000 drone strikes in Afghanistan between 2015 and 2020, killing up to 10,000 people, according to statistics kept by the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. The CIA, relying on cell phone numbers to find, fix, and finish its alleged enemies, often launched its Hellfire missiles at the wrong targets or at targets standing amid groups of civilians. The practice devastated Afghan villages. Yet the United States regime refused to keep track of civilian casualties from drone strikes. Instead, officials insisted that each strike had hit its intended target, while ignoring the claims of villagers that the missiles had killed a tribal chief or decimated a meeting of village elders. Along with drone strikes came night raids, in which U.S. forces would burst into a home in the middle of the night and kill or capture those inside, breeding further resentment. The raids were so deeply unpopular that they sometimes led an entire village to switch its allegiance to the Taliban. That was worse. The U.S. military and the CIA failed for years to fully grasp the degree to which their airstrikes and night raids were being manipulated by Afghans who fed them false information to convince the Americans to launch raids against their local rivals or have those rivals carted off to Guantanamo. The shift of American resources by the Bush administration to Iraq in 2002 and 2003 was the greatest military miscalculation of the entire war in Afghanistan. While the United States was distracted by Iraq, the Taliban, which had been all but defeated and dispersed, recovered and regained strength. Yet, even as the Bush administration drew down militarily in Afghanistan, it is still insisted on creating a new pro-Western government in Kabul and began a massive nation-building project in the country. It did so without grasping the significance of several basic facts about conditions it faced. As the Taliban revived, the Bush administration had few troops left in Afghanistan to counter the threat. Within a few years of its initial victory in 2001, the United States regime was stuck in a quagmire of its own making in Afghanistan, just as it did was in Iraq. For 20 years, America essentially ran a narco state in Afghanistan. During the initial invasion and bombing campaign in 2001, the Bush administration ignored the drug problem, believing that it was a distraction from America's main counterterrorism mission, and refused to bomb drug-related facilities. The U.S. spent nearly $9 billion on its token counter-narcotics programs in Afghanistan, yet opium production and heroin smuggling in Afghanistan skyrocketed under the U.S.-backed regime. Afghanistan now produces more than 80% of the world's heroin supply. Afghanistan's opium production soared in 2002 and just kept growing. By 2020, 224,000 hectares of land were under opium poppy cultivation in Afghanistan, compared with 123,000 hectares in 2010, according to the United Nations. The U.S. provided $145 billion over 20 years to rebuild the country that had a gross domestic product of just $19 billion in 2019. As recently as 2018, nearly 80% of Afghan government spending came from Western donors. The combined effects of the massive flows of Western aid dollars funding for combat operations and the river of narco dollars created a surreal economic bubble in Afghanistan. A new Western-style urban professional class sprang up in Kabul, many of whose members are now fleeing the Taliban. But the money also triggered an epidemic of corruption and insider dealing that thoroughly discredited both the Afghan central government and the United States regime. Much of the American money enriched U.S. contractors without ever entering the Afghan economy. Much of it also disappeared into secret bank accounts in Dubai, United Arab Emirates, held by Afghan government officials, warlords, and their families. A phenomena described in a 2020 report by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace as the cross-pollination of criminality between Afghanistan and Dubai. Meanwhile, petty corruption, bribes to local officials to obtain any service or job, was endemic, stoking more resentment against the government among average Afghans. The UN found that by 2012, Afghans were paying $3.9 million in bribes per year. Half of all Afghans paid a bribe for a public service. As the US-backed government continued, petty bribery and corruption grew worse, not better. Militias were using their position and closeness with the government and U.S. military to control roads, secure lucrative contracts, establish themselves as regional powers, and sometimes serve both sides, cooperating with both international and Taliban forces to maximize profits, concluded a 2018 report from the Institute of World Politics. The government-fueled bribery and corruption forced many Afghans into the arm of the Taliban, who gained the reputation of settling financial and other disputes using more straightforward, if far more brutal, methods. Trying to compete with the Taliban's dispute resolution would have meant allowing laws, and that's not something we could do politically. Barnett Robin, a longtime Afghanistan expert who advised the State Department, told the Special Inspector General. Perhaps the most cynical decision in the war in Afghanistan was taken by Obama in 2009. During the 2008 presidential campaign, Obama sought to distinguish himself from his main political rivals with his emphatic denunciations of the war in Iraq. Fearful of being attacked from the right for being too dovish, Obama balanced his attacks on the Iraq war by claiming that he would do more than the Bush administration had done to win the war in Afghanistan. In 2009, Obama announced that he was escalating U.S. troop levels in Afghanistan, his ill-considered Afghan surge. The surge came with no real long-term strategy, and it is hard not to see Obama's decision as little more than a political calculation to live up to his earlier campaign promise, which had only been made to insulate him from attacks on his position on Iraq. As American troops flowed steadily into Afghanistan in 2009 and 2010, combat operations were focused on the south, notably Helmand province, a stronghold of both the Taliban and opium production. U.S. troop levels peaked at about 100,000 during the surge, the highest levels of the entire war in Afghanistan. But the surge quickly descended into an inconclusive war of attrition. U.S. casualties reached their highest levels of the war during the surge, with fatalities rising to 496 in 2010. Obama drew down U.S. forces to around 8,400 by the time he left office. Donald Trump came into the presidency in 2017, having campaigned on a vow to end America's forever wars. He was determined to withdraw all U.S. troops from Afghanistan, but he was easily distracted by cronies eager to make money. Eric Prince, the infamous founder of Blackwater, nearly convinced Trump to let him take over the entire combat mission in Afghanistan by using paid mercenaries instead of U.S. troops. Instead, Trump got so sidetracked that he let the Pentagon talk him into increasing troop levels at about 14,000 in 2017. Trump finally got his way in February 2020 when the U.S. and the Taliban signed an agreement setting the conditions for a complete withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan by May 1, 2021. After the 2020 presidential election, Acting Defense Secretary Chris Miller announced that U.S. troop levels had been reduced to 2,500. Joe Biden came into office this year, making the case that after 20 years, the war in Afghanistan had to end. Getting out of Afghanistan was perhaps the only issue on which he publicly agreed with Donald Trump. On April 14th, he announced that all U.S. troops would be withdrawn by September 11th, 2021, the 20th anniversary of 9/11. Trump promptly criticized Biden for failing to meet the May 1st deadline he had negotiated with the Taliban, saying that we can and should get out earlier, and that getting out of Afghanistan is a wonderful and positive thing to do. I plan to withdraw on May 1st, and we should keep as close to that schedule as possible, unquote. The Taliban also issued a statement in April criticizing Biden for failing to meet the agreed-upon deadline. They warned ominously that the delay opens the way for the Taliban to take every necessary countermeasure. In an interview with the Special Inspector General, Douglas Lute, who coordinated strategy for Afghanistan at the National Security Council from 2007 to 2013, gave a brief and devastating critique of the American enterprise in Afghanistan. Lute said, "We were devoid of a fundamental understanding of Afghanistan. We didn't know what we were doing."
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we looked at how the ongoing epidemic of men's violence in America is rooted in this inability as a society to move beyond outmoded ideals of manhood. In a sweeping analysis that cut across racial, ethnic, and class lines, we examined mass shootings, day-to-day gun violence, violence against women, bullying, and American militarism against the backdrop of a culture that has normalized violent and regressive forms of masculinity in the face of challenges to traditional male power and authority. Stay with us for the rest of the program.
It turns out that Lord Baden-Powell bonded the Boy Scout for a very explicit reason, to counteract what he perceived as a decline in the manly virtues. In his influential book, Rovering to Success, A Guide to Young Manhood, Powell was quite explicit about this. "God made men to be men," he wrote. "Civilization, with its town life, buses, hot and cold water laid on, everything done for you, tends to make men soft and feckless beings. We badly need training for our lads if we are to keep up manliness in our race instead of lapsing into a nation of soft, sloppy cigarette suckers."
The Scout program is designed to help our sons, cousins, and younger brothers develop the initiative, the resourcefulness, the character, the quick thinking, and the leadership they really need in the somewhat jittery, insecure world in which we live.
Again and again at key moments in American history, you see men reacting to change in just this way by retreating into a hyper-masculine fantasy world. You see it in the rise of popular men's magazines in the 1940s, filled with stories about breathtaking manly adventures in sports. These magazines may look retro to us today, but what's important to remember is that they were just as retro in their own time. As the lives of men grew more sedentary during the consumer boom of the post-war years, as women moved into the workplace in unprecedented numbers and the women's movement gained traction, these magazines offered men a way to hit back at what Ralph Day, the editorial director of True Magazine, describes as the perils of creeping equality. Men were turning to his magazine in unprecedented numbers, Day explained to a group of men in a speech, because it stimulates his masculine ego at a time when man wants to fight back against women's efforts to usurp his traditional role as head of the family. And this backlash has only accelerated exponentially since the 1960s, when the civil rights movement, the women's movement, and the anti-war movement rose up to challenge traditional masculine authority like never before, especially the authority of straight white men.
The plain truth of the matter is this has to stop, and it has to stop like the day before yesterday.
Feminism was established so that unattractive, ugly broads could have easy access to the mainstream, right? Did you see it? Yes!
Look at our political culture, where the game is all about establishing your manly credentials by butching yourself up and methodically feminizing and taking apart the manhood of your opponents.
And to those critics who are so pessimistic about our economy, I say, don't be economic girly man.
There was no clearer depiction of this backlash phenomenon than the film Fight Club. The movie portrayed the emasculation of young men by the consumer culture.
We're still men.
Yes, we're men. Men is what we are.
And offered up bare-knuckled violence as a way for men to reclaim their manhood. Regardless of whether we see film as a glamorization or a satire of backlash masculinity, backyard fight clubs have proliferated in the years since the film's release. And at the base of all of this is the belief that the best way for men to restore their dwindling manhood and restore order is through what the cultural historian Richard Slotkin has called the frontier myth of regenerative violence.
Most people understand that guns make you safer, especially because society is degenerating. There's going to be a lot of craziness going on. And so we need guns to protect ourselves.
To older working and middle-class white men, the message is clear.
That's the thing that gets me. If I lived on the border and some brown man came running through my backyard that looks like he didn't belong there, then why aren't people doing that?
The basic idea is that the best way to regain power and control is through a barrel of a gun, or as many guns as possible.
They're accurate. They are dependable.
Yes, they are. Super dependable.
They are extremely well made. You can carry plenty of them
right.
on your person
right.
at all times.
This white male paranoia and siege mentality have fueled the increasingly aggressive effort to block even the most sensible gun policies.
When the system is overwhelmed, and I mean the system on the entire planet, somebody had better be prepared to protect themselves, their families, their neighborhoods, and the freedom of all mankind. Never let them take your Second Amendment right, ever.
This siege mentality has also fueled the rise of hate groups and militias over the past quarter century.
They're not branches of Al-Qaeda. They're right-wing extremists with lots of guns and an axe to grind against the U.S. government.
Listen, people. Things are bad. Things are real bad. And it's going to get a lot worse. So basically, if people need to wake up, start buying some of these, see?
Groups like these are often described as white supremacist hate groups, which they usually are. But they can also be seen as a kind of reactionary men's movement, an organized expression of white male anxiety and aggrieved entitlement that relies on violence as the preferred means of attaining its goals.
Recovery crews are still searching the waters around an island where a gunman opened fire on young people attending a summer camp.
In recent years, perhaps the most disgusting and morally bankrupt expression of this kind of threatened entitlement was the massacre of 77 people, including 69 teenagers, perpetrated by the Norwegian right-wing fanatic Anders Breivik, a former customer service representative who had been declared unfit for service in the Norwegian army. In his 1,500-page manifesto explaining his reasons for the attack, Breivik ranted against culturalism, but he reserved special venom for feminism's role in emasculating Western men. According to Breivik, feminist ideology and political correctness have been responsible for transforming a patriarchy into a matriarchy and intend to deny the intrinsic worth of males. And by now, men have been reduced to an emasculated, touchy-feely subspecies. What this shows is that a whole lot of men out there fear they're losing control and are turning to violence to reclaim their manhood. In his fascinating study of violence, the psychiatrist James Gilligan interviewed hundreds of violent criminals in American prisons and found that the single most powerful reason they turned to violence was because they felt shamed, humiliated, or disrespected as men. The more time I spent with him, Gilligan writes about one of the hundreds of violent criminals he has interviewed over the course of his research, the clearer it became that his character served as a defense against the threat of being treated with scorn and disrespect, of being perceived as a weakling, not a real man, someone who could be laughed at. We may not hear about it much in mainstream coverage of violence, but again and again we've seen exactly this dynamic. Young men using violence to overcome the shame of not being seen and respected as real men.
16-year-old Luke Woodham entered the commons area of Pearl High and fired off several shots.
Woodham opened fire at Pearl High School, killing two students.
Consider Luke Woodham, who carried out a school shooting in Pearl, Mississippi in the late 1990s. Woodham wrote a letter before he went on his rampage explaining himself this way. I am not insane, I am angry. I killed because people like me are mistreated every day. All throughout my